Chapter 9. My second case was another stabbing. At about 9 o'clock one night, I was called to an ordinary London red-brick terraced house, distinguishable from all the other houses in the road only by the presence of the police outside. Inside was an unexpectedly ornate interior. On the banisters, blood. I followed the trail upstairs, and, just inside a bedroom door, feet nearest, naked in a huge puddle of blood, lay a grey-haired man, face down. I pushed the door open. The dull, patterned wallpaper darkened the room, and large, heavy wooden furniture darkened it further. Although cluttered, everything was in its place. The alarm clock, the radio, the framed photos, the small TV on a mahogany chest of drawers facing the bed. Here was the room of a man who led a well-ordered working life. But that well-ordered life had been extinguished, and the working man was lying awash with his own blood. It was difficult to tread round him. His back was patterned with spatters and rivulets of blood. There was blood on the wall. The bed was half covered by a duvet, but this did not hide the huge, deep bloodstains over the sheets. On the floor, by an electrical socket, almost floating in blood, was a long, wooden-handled kitchen knife. I turned the body over with great care. I could see one gaping knife wound in his chest. I thought there were probably more wounds hidden by blood. Then I took his temperature. Since he was already naked, this was easy. Taking a rectal temperature, especially if it involves removing clothes, can create forensic chaos, so I had already learned that quite often it is better to get the body straight to the mortuary and take the temperature there. Now I saw that the victim's temperature was 26.6 degrees centigrade. The detective who was watching me said, "So, Doc, what time did he die exactly?" My heart sank, especially at the word exactly. That's the question everyone asks first. That's the question everyone thinks we can answer. That's the question which reveals the huge gap between the public perception of pathologists and the truth. I blame those TV cop shows. The fact is, it is very hard indeed for us to determine with any accuracy when a death occurred. The detective was waiting. I said, "Well, I can't be sure." Body temperature may be the best forensic indicator we have for estimating the time of death, but it is not a very reliable one. Basic physics tells us that a hot body will cool as its heat passes into the cooler environment. But of course, it's not that simple. A generalization would be that a body feels cold to touch within 8 hours of death. It's not that simple either. In fact, a body may not feel cold for as much as 36 hours, and residual metabolic activity may mean the temperature never drops to the ambient level. Then, when decomposition is underway, the temperature will even start to rise. There are so many variables that can affect the rate at which we cool after death. Body temperature when death occurs, the environmental temperature, fluctuations in the weather, central heating, open windows, the amount of clothing on the body, the TOG value of a duvet over it, the posture of the body. As we all instinctively know, a curled position retains more heat. Body weight, fat is a good insulator. Muscle bulk, less muscle means faster cooling. And the age of the deceased. Children have a larger surface area to body weight and so lose heat more quickly. A multitude of small factors make it a mug's game to estimate the time of death from the temperature of a body. Even a computer program, after taking countless variables into account, would still not be able to give an accurate answer about the time of death. It may suggest that death occurred between a range of times, but those times would probably be many hours apart. And still no one would expect accuracy of more than 90%. The detective nodded wisely. He said, "I expect you'll be able to tell from the rigor mortis." "Well, no, that's another misconception. Rigor mortis is one of death's most obvious processes, but it is so highly variable that it is an even less reliable basis than body temperature for estimating the time of death. Its speed and onset are determined by temperature. A body outside in a cold winter may have no rigor after a week, although there can be a rapid onset of rigor as the body warms up when it's brought into the higher temperature of the mortuary. And there are other confounding factors. Was the deceased exercising just prior to death? Rigor mortis will be faster due to the lactic acid produced by physical exertion. Was death associated with a high fever? Again, rigor will be faster. Was electrocution the cause of death? This speeds up rigor, perhaps because of the stimulation of the muscle cells. Did death take place in front of a warm fire? faster rigor. In a hot bath, faster rigor. Rigor mortis is actually caused by complex changes that occur once the heart has stopped beating and the muscle cells are deprived of the oxygen they need in order to metabolize. For years, rigor was assumed to start in the face, as anyone making a delayed attempt at mouth-to-mouth resuscitation may recognize. We now understand that it develops uniformly throughout the body, but that it is simply most detectable in the smaller muscles first. And these small muscles are found mainly in the jaw and around the eyes and fingers. As a generalization, rigor can be felt in these areas about 3 hours after death. It then appears to spread down the body from the head to the legs, although in fact this is just the differential stiffening of larger and larger muscle groups. The stiffening of the muscles generally occurs faster than the body cools, so there is usually a period when the body is both warm and stiff. And it doesn't last forever. Rigor mortis wears off after a day or so, and the muscles become flaccid again. In a temperate climate like the UK, rigor mortis may have affected all of the muscles, fully established rigor, within 12 hours. In hot equatorial regions, rigor can be fully established and then disappear in just 1 hour. And it may sometimes seem that certain people, the very young, the very old, or the emaciated, don't have it at all, because they have so little muscle bulk. Its strength can be surprising. There are famous pictures of full rigor, with the head on one chair and feet on another, and the unsupported body in between as straight as a board. So performing a post-mortem on a body in a state of rigor mortis poses its own problems, unless the deceased has obligingly died on his back with his arms by his sides. The easiest choice is to wait for rigor to pass. Unfortunately, waiting is not an option for the forensic pathologist helping in a homicide investigation, where speed is of the essence. That night, I soon left the blood-filled bedroom for the mortuary. The deceased arrived very shortly after me. His neck, arms, jaw, and knees had rigor mortis, and he had actually died with one arm behind him and one folded in front. His right leg was raised. I needed him to lie flat for the post-mortem, and so I had to break rigor. This can require some strength. If an arm is bent, I must push firmly on the joint until I break the chemical bonds between the molecules of actin and myosin in the cells. Once that bond is broken, the arm can be laid down flat on the table. But sometimes, if the rigor is particularly strong, for instance, if the deceased is a muscled young man whose job involved heavy lifting, I'll need a mortuary assistant to help me. Breaking rigor involves putting considerable pressure on a specific joint to loosen the muscle, and it then gives way gradually, not suddenly like a bone snapping. In this case, the patient was 62 years old, and rigor was quite easily broken by vigorously moving the arms backwards and forwards until they felt loose. At the repeated request of the police officers, I used the two unreliable guides, body temperature and stiffness, to arrive at a range of times between which death might have occurred, bearing in mind that there are any number of variables, of course. In this case, I gave an estimated time since death of 4 to 6 hours. "Well done, Doc," said the senior detective who was just coming into the post-mortem room after taking a phone call. "The bloke who killed him says it was about 4:30, 5 o'clock this afternoon." "You've got him already?" "He's just turned himself in. They were in a homosexual relationship. Says he lost his temper." It was quite a serious loss of temper. There were 8 stab wounds, one of them a really gaping wound on the outside, which inside had directly penetrated the heart. So clearly do knives leave their tracks and hilts their bruises, that I was able to sketch with detailed dimensions the weapon which had been used by the murderer. It was my first knife sketch ever based on wound tracks, and I was amazed when it exactly matched the dimensions of the kitchen knife the police found at the scene. From now on, Shepherd was a knife man. In addition, although this does seem to me, looking back, like ludicrous overenthusiasm, I thought I could establish exactly what had happened from the wounds themselves and from the bloodstaining around the room. That was, after all, what Professor Simpson would have done. A telltale spattering on the wall said that the first and fatal injury was inflicted here. The wound was in the left upper chest, and its track was slightly left to right. Classic. This told me that the killer was right-handed, that both he and the victim had been standing, and that he'd used an overarm downward thrust. The victim then collapsed onto the left side of the bed. That was clear from the position of the bloodstains on the sheets, and from the thin lines of blood spattered on the ceiling above, cast-off staining, which is the result of blood flying from the blade's tip as the assailant raises the knife to stab again, it was easy to deduce that the killer had stood over his victim while stabbing him three more times. The victim had rolled out of bed and crawled for the door. This was evidence from the trail of blood he had left. The final four stab wounds were almost certainly inflicted here, by the door, where the victim had died in a pool of blood. But the killer might have saved himself the effort. The first thrust was fatal, and after it penetrated his heart, the victim had only minutes to live. The proximity and uniformity of these four wounds, all at the same angle, each a copy of the last, indicated that the victim was motionless by this point, and perhaps already dead. And what about the blood I had seen smeared on the banisters? That had certainly been left by the blooded, departing boyfriend. It was all over for the victim before he had reached the door. The killer had already confessed, but nevertheless, I was so proud of my deductions that after the post-mortem, I insisted on telling the detective. "Uh-huh," he said, without interest. "Look, you can see here." I held out the helpful diagram I had drawn. He did not take it. Ever eager, I now offered to write a statement explaining my reconstruction of events. He blinked and looked away. "Nah, don't bother, Doc. No one will read it. The bloke's coughed." I was greatly disappointed. It was my first inkling that the police really do not want me to play Sherlock Holmes, or even Keith Simpson. My hero was an invaluable part of the crime-solving team in the first half of the 20th century, and was involved throughout homicide investigations at every level, throwing theories around with high-ranking officers or counsel, discussing clues with detectives at the scene. I'd like to do that too. Sometimes I'm bursting to tell the police exactly what my skills and training suggest happened. But police investigation has changed. The science of homicide has now become such a specialized business that the many disciplines involved offer their separate facts, and the police coordinate everyone's findings and come to their own conclusions. That can work, as long as the officers are skilled and experienced. Next, the decision to charge or not is made by Crown Prosecution Service lawyers. Fine, as long as the lawyers don't struggle when confronted by complex medical issues. I think the system would be most effective if we could all sit down together when a case is difficult and complicated. The police and the CPS with the pathologist, the forensic scientists, the blood spatter specialist, the toxicologist, the ballistics expert, and discuss our facts together. But we seldom do that any longer.